God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
So first of all, let me start by saying thank you, everybody, for being here today. My name's Ken, and I am an alcoholic. When Bill Wilson and the group of alcoholics who started AA wrote the book Alcoholics Anonymous, they had an intent. What do you suppose that was?
To help
other alcoholics stay sober. They had this intention in mind when they wrote this book. The intention was that wherever you lived in the world, they could mail this book to you, you could read it, understand what it meant to be an alcoholic as far as their understanding was, and understand that there was a solution that they had found that worked in their lives, and put that solution into application in your own life. They really genuinely meant that you could follow the 12 steps out of the book exactly as they had them written, and that you would have the same result that they had had, which they considered the result to be lasting sobriety. And so they wrote this book. They started writing it. I think Bill Wilson was sober about a year and a half at the time. And what had happened was Bill had gone to Akron, Ohio on a business trip. And while in Akron, Ohio, he was in a hotel lobby. And his business wasn't going so well. And he thought he was going to drink. He was walking back and forth in front of a bar. And inside the bar, he saw people laughing and having a great time. And he thought, wow, maybe I could go in and have a ginger ale, and I'd make a new acquaintance or a friend, and it would be somebody that would have a conversation with and forget about my troubles. And for the first time in all of his drinking, he panicked. For a brief moment, he realized that that was the insidious insanity of the first drink, and that if he went in that bar under the guise of having a ginger ale, that he would end up getting drunk. And so instead of going into the bar and having a ginger ale, he turned to the left, saw a church directory, and started calling numbers to try and find another alcoholic to work with. And what Bill realized in that moment was key in what we later practiced in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was that Bill realized that he needed another alcoholic to stay sober more than any other alcoholic may need him. That in that moment, for him, the solution to not drinking was to find another alcoholic to work with. So he started calling people, and eventually through a series of phone calls, he got put in touch with Bob Smith, who we now call Dr. Bob. And Bill and Dr. Bob met for the first time, and it was really a funny story because Dr. Bob, of course, was quite drunk the first time that Bill called, and so his wife made some friendly excuse as to why she wouldn't be able to meet with him, but set up the meeting for the next day. And the only way that they got Bob to agree to go meet Bill was that they told Bob that this was some poor alcoholic from New York that needed help. And what Bob was thinking was, gee, I'm really a sick and sorry SOB if I don't go help this poor guy. So he made his wife promise that he would only have to be there for 15 minutes. And so the 15-minute conversation turned into a three-hour conversation, and at that moment, history for us was made. 6 months or so later, Bill and Bob met, and in the conversation that they had, they figured between the group that Bill had started in New York and the group that Dr. Bob had been successful in starting in Akron, Ohio, they had about 40 recoveries. Now, to us, that's the amount of people that are in the room at the moment, right? So to us, we think 40 just isn't that big a deal. But in 1936, I think it was at the time, 40 people who had recovered from the hopeless state of mind and body that we call alcoholism was miraculous. Because prior to Bill and Bob meeting, nothing had brought about a solution that had impacted 40 people who suffered from alcoholism. Nothing. There was no medical treatment that anybody had been able to create up until that point that provided people with a solution to alcoholism. If you were diagnosed, and even in the book they tell us that doctors are rightly loath, they say, in other words, very hesitant to tell an alcoholic of his condition. Because if you diagnose somebody as a physician, if you diagnose somebody as an alcoholic, what that meant was that you were giving them a death sentence. Because everybody knew that there was nothing an alcoholic could do to stop drinking. A few people had been able to have what we now call vital spiritual experiences, which had given them the opportunity to stop drinking, but those were few and far between. It was very rare that anybody was able to ever stop drinking on their own volition or through achieving any other spiritual result. So Bill and Bob looked around and they saw that they had 40 recoveries between them, and they were like, wow, this is huge. They realized that it was too much to ask of other people in the world that everybody should have to come to either Akron, Ohio or New York City if they were going to meet them and get sober. It just wasn't really feasible for people to do that. And so they knew they had to find another way to communicate the message. Prior to writing the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, what would happen is somebody who you knew or a family member of yours, if you were an alcoholic, would have read an article about AA or been in touch with somebody who knew this secret society, you know, as we referred to it back then, of recovered alcoholics, and they would get you in touch with somebody who would come do a 12-step call on you. In the early times of AA, they called it the visit. And so one of these alcoholics would come visit. Usually you would be in a hospital by that time because your condition was pretty bad if somebody was needing to intervene on your behalf. And they would come visit you, and they would have a conversation with you. And it would be a frank, open, honest conversation about their condition as an alcoholic. And in that conversation, they would reveal to you the conclusion that they came to, which was that they had lost the power of choice in drink. There was no amount of self-knowledge that they could create or that they could produce or that anybody else could produce, no human ability whatsoever to get them to stop drinking. And that as long as they continued on the path they were on, it was certain destruction, that there was no way out. It was a hopeless and futile way of life. And so they would have that conversation with you, and if you became convinced that that was your experience as well, and you were interested in talking to them again, they would come back and visit you the next day, giving you a little bit of time to think about your situation and the conversation that you had had. And in that second visit, if you said, you know, I really think this applies to me, and I think I need this thing that you guys have, then they would offer you the program of action. And at that point, it was a 6-step program. It wasn't orchestrated as 6 direct steps that you took, but it was essentially a 6-step program. And the 6-step program worked in combination with a lot of philosophies that they had gotten from a group of people called the Oxford Group. And so they would offer you the 6-step program. And if you said, yeah, I'm willing, I'm ready, then you took the 3rd step. They would acquaint you with the inventory taking process that they had developed. You would write an inventory. They would leave. You'd finish that up. They would come back the next day or the day after. You would do what we now refer to as a 5th step with that person. Or if you wanted to talk to somebody else, you know, they could have somebody else come along sometimes. And you would acquaint that person with your general defects of character. You would say a little prayer about that. And then you would make a list of all the people you had harmed. And you would get up and leave the hospital either on the 3rd or 4th day and go out and start making the amends to all the people you had harmed. The world was a much smaller place back then, so most of us didn't harm people in foreign countries. Most of us harmed people that lived on our block, right? So it was a lot easier to go make your amends back then. You didn't have to get on an airplane and fly to Timbuktu. You just had to go across town and apologize to your banker. So you would go out and you would start making your amends, and that night you would get together and they would usually have a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, even though it wasn't called that yet, and you would sit around with a bunch of other guys who had been through the process, and you would talk about your experience with that, and you would share some spiritual inspiration or strength or hope with each other. And there was readings that they would do from different sources, and that was essentially what happened. Shortly thereafter, like within a matter of a few days, you'd be right back in the same hospital you had just gotten out of, talking to the next person in the bed. And that's the way it worked. And so then you would meet regularly with your comrades in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you would continue to go out and carry the message to the still suffering alcoholic. And so literally in a matter of a week or two, you had it worked through the steps, what we now call the steps, and you would achieve sobriety. And so what they found was that it worked dramatically well for alcoholics. Why do you suppose they found such success rate? Why did it work so well? If nothing else that these guys did or these women did got them to stop drinking, why did this system, this short process that they came up with, work so well? Anybody got an idea? Speak up, please. Fellowship, that was a big part of it, right? So they had found another group of people with whom they could relate to. What else? They had totally surrendered. So the thing was that when they approached these people, they were at the bottom of the barrel. And so they were willing to go to any lengths to get sober. Notice that after the first conversation that they had with somebody, if the person at that point said, you know, thank you very much, the information you gave me is great, I think knowing what I know now, I can go ahead and stop on my own. They would never push the issue. Okay. Please. But if it doesn't work out for you, feel free to give us a call. We'd be happy to meet with you again. So surrender was the number one reason for success. What else?
A spiritual experience.
Instead of relying on their own willpower to stop drinking, the message that these recovered alcoholics carried to the newcomer was you had to find a relationship with a power greater than yourself, and that's where your dependence for sobriety comes on. What else?
A lot of it was done, the steps were performed on an inpatient setting.
So that the steps were performed in the hospital, you mean? That's not it. Nothing wrong with being wrong here, by the way. Let's throw that out right now. And in the conversation that we have today, shout out, raise your hand, contribute. There's nothing the matter with throwing something out there and having it be wrong. Okay? So the 6-point plan that they had come up with for sobriety had 3 fundamental characteristics. The first was surrender. You had to be completely defeated, right? William James later calls it the experience of deflation at depth. Okay, so we had to, at the bottom of our being, know that the condition we experienced was hopelessness and futile, that we just couldn't go on drinking, and there was nothing we could do of our own power to stay sober. The second part was the fundamental component of finding a relationship with a power greater than yourself. Right? The first part is willingness. The second part is finding this relationship with a power greater than yourself. And that's the basis for your sobriety, that your sobriety is based in this relationship with a power greater than yourself. And then the third part was in giving of yourself. At the very beginning of the book, they introduced the book to us, and in the doctor's opinion, in the little part where Bill Wilson writes in between the two doctor's opinions, he says, we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. So this program of Alcoholics Anonymous has 2 fundamental places in which it takes place in our lives. One is in our relationship with a power greater than ourselves, and the second is in getting out of ourselves and giving of ourselves to others without the expectation of them doing anything in return for what we're doing. So that's why we started this whole thing off this morning with me being able to look out at you and say thank you for being here today, and what's going to happen is I'm going to be able to stay sober as a result of doing this. All the rest of you, I hope, will get something great out of being here today. And I think that you'll have a good experience. And I know that what I'll be able to communicate to you is the fundamental understanding for how to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what we're going to go over the next 2 days. And what you'll get when we're done with this is you'll have under your belt the ability to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you'll be able to put those into application in your life. That's what they found worked back then. What worked so well for them was that the guy that came out of the hospital only 3 or 4 days prior would go back to the hospital with one intention in mind, to share what he had gotten so freely with another alcoholic. And in doing that, he was going to be able to achieve sobriety. And so that's what they found that worked. Bill and Bob met. They talked about what had happened. They talked about how many people had gotten sober. And they knew that what they had to do was come up with a way to communicate that message to alcoholics all around the world. And so they proceeded to write the book that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it the Big Book. They proceeded to write this book with the intention that anybody, anywhere in the world, could pick it up and read it and follow the precise set of directions, which is what they refer to them as in the foreword to the first edition, Roman numeral 13, which is XIII, at the top of the page. They say, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Precisely how we have recovered. That's the statement that they're trying to make to us at the beginning of the book. So what we want to understand is that there's a precise set of directions in Alcoholics Anonymous. To the precise extent that we put those into application, are we going to get the same thing that they got, which is lasting recovery? They don't say how we're recovering. They say to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. They considered themselves recovered alcoholics. Why do you suppose that is? Because today we talk about being in recovery. but back then they talked about being recovered alcoholics. They introduced the book from the standpoint of being a recovered alcoholic. Any ideas? What does it mean to be recovered from something? The problem doesn't exist for them anymore, right? They're recovered. The problem's been removed. So skip forward in your books to page 84. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor had been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. So in Alcoholics Anonymous, when they start the book and they introduce this idea to us that it's a precise set of directions, and they tell us that this is the set of directions that they've followed to become recovered alcoholics, what they're letting us know is that the strange twist in thinking, the mental obsession which we suffer from if we find that we're alcoholic, which tells us today I can drink and it'll be different no matter how much experience I have in the past with things going awry when I drink, that's been removed. The problem has been removed for us, right? It does not exist, is the wording they use on page 85. If we want the results that they got when they wrote this book, we've got to follow the same set of directions that they came up with. That doesn't mean that if you work the steps some other way than is outlined in the book, that that's wrong, bad, less than, better than, any of that. There's as many different ways to work the 12 steps as there are people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we all approach it in the place that we're in. What it does mean is that if you veer off the course that they laid out in front of us, you're not going to get the same result that they get. We're going to talk more about this later, but if you're on a ship and you're trying to get from here to Jamaica, you're going to pull out a chart and you're going to plot a course. It's going to be a series of lines that are going to get you to the location you're trying to go to. So we're going to get in the boat, we're going to start going. Now, halfway through the trip, what we decide is instead of turning right at the Bahamas, what we want to do is we just want to veer off to the left a little bit. Now we're going to veer off course. What do you suppose is going to happen? Yeah, we're going to end up somewhere else. Well, it's the same way that Alcoholics Anonymous works. It's a precise set of directions. That's what we get in the foreword of the first edition. And what happens for us is when we veer off course with the precise set of directions and we start creating other ways to work the program, then we get some other result. Now, the result that we just read on page 84 and 85 is a great promise to become a recovered alcoholic. You'll notice that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous actually begins on page 60. On page 60, the end of how it works, we read it in every meeting. We say that A, that we're alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Being convinced, we were at step 3. But as we go through the first 4 chapters of the book, we never get to the point where we read a statement that says, this is where we work step 1, this is where we work step 2. Steps 1 and 2 are conclusions that we come to through gathering a little bit of information and taking a look at our lives. And when we reach those conclusions, we're at step 3, which is where we make the decision. Step 3 begins on page 60. Skipping forward to page 84 to the paragraph that we read where it tells us that we're recovered alcoholics, it's 24 pages. So the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that we practice in order to achieve recovery from alcoholism, to have the mental twist be removed for us, takes place in 24 short pages. So it's a precise set of directions. There's not much room in those 24 pages for us to veer off course. Problem that most of us have is we stop somewhere along the process. For most of us, that's usually around the inventory taking. Of all the people in the room today, how many people have relapsed since they made the decision they were going to stop drinking? Show of hands. 2/3, 3/4 of the people in the room, so that's probably about 40 people, 30 people, have relapsed in drinking. Of the people who put their hands up, how many people were in the process of taking inventory or had completed the process of taking inventory? Okay, so that's 6 or 8. So that's the first place that most of us get in trouble, is we never complete the house cleaning process. Remember, we just figured out it's only 24 pages. that it takes to become a recovered alcoholic. So we can't miss much. So if we miss the house cleaning process, which is all of that 24 pages, then we're in trouble. So the second thing that we often get in trouble with is doing 12-step work. So of all of us who put our hands up, the 30 or 40 people who raised their hands and said they had relapsed, how many people were actively doing 12-step work at the time that they relapsed? Actively working with another alcoholic and you decided, I'm going to go get drunk. You were in the middle of doing a 12-step call and you went and drank? So you're the first one ever. One out of 30. Oh, you went by yourself. Okay. So that might have not actually been a 12-step call. That might have been a mission to use. So can we give up your one as the statistic? Okay. So far, I haven't met anybody. I've been sober for 18 years, and I've been actively leading these big book workshops for the past 5 or 6 years, I guess. And so far, I haven't met anybody who said, I cleaned house, I was developing a relationship with a power greater than myself, and I was working with other alcoholics, and the thought to drink came along, and I acted on it. And I just found myself drunk. I've never met anybody that said that. Thank goodness that you were actually on a mission to use and not a mission to do a 12-step call. That would have blown my whole line from this point forward. Whew. We escaped that one, a narrow miss, right? So this is the solution that AA has to offer for the drink problem. And to the precise extent, right, it's a precise set of directions, to the precise extent that you put it into application in your life, will you achieve the result that they got. So the invitation that I extend to you today is to listen as we're going through the book from a place of trying to understand what Bill Wilson intended us to know about how to get sober and how to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you listen from that place, you'll probably have some great insights in that. One of my sponsors once shared with me, it's a good idea to not highlight or mark up your big book. Because what happens for us is we highlight, and I know it's kind of a shock, right? It's a good idea. That's our friend who was on the mission to use was surprised when I said that. So it's a good idea to not mark up or highlight your big book, because what happens is when you go back and read your big book later, you'll read what you marked or highlighted, and you'll miss the message. You'll pay attention to what you already know is important, and you'll miss the message that AA has to offer you. So my sponsor pointed out to me very early on in sobriety, he said, because I said, well, if the intent of writing this book was to give me a precise set of directions, then what do I need you for? It's a good question, right? So he looked at me and he said, well, Ken, that's because nothing you've been able to do up until now has worked. And if you read the book by yourself, that won't work either. He pointed out to me that I had a problem with comprehension. But it wasn't a normal problem with comprehension, because I knew what most of the words meant in the book and things like that. He said, your problem with comprehension is that you never pay attention to anything that you have to do to get comprehension. He said, when you read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you think about what it means rather than understanding what it says. What he pointed out to me was that very rarely do I actually read the book Alcoholics Anonymous with the intention of understanding what Bill Wilson was trying to communicate to me. Most of the time, and the reason why I hadn't been able to get sober up until that moment, was because I would read the book Alcoholics Anonymous already knowing what it said and already thinking about what that meant to me. And so inside of reading from that place, I wasn't able to really ever get what Bill Wilson was trying to communicate to me. So I invite you today, and as we go through the book study over the next 2 days, to try and listen to what we're going to do in the book from the place of really understanding the intention that Bill Wilson and the first alcoholics had in mind when they wrote down what they wrote down for us. Because that's where the key to sobriety lies. You're welcome to do that if you'd like. If you prefer, you're welcome to highlight and underline and mark anything you want to in your book. And either way, hopefully we'll still have a good time. Yes, ma'am. Okay, so we said that it's a precise set of directions, right? The book starts in the foreword to the first edition, the very first paragraph, by telling us it's a precise set of directions. And so the precise set of directions for how to achieve sobriety, which is the result we read about on page 84, starts on page 60 with the A, B, and C, right? We conclude that we're alcoholic. We conclude that probably no human power can relieve our alcoholism. And we believe, or we start to develop the hope or the faith that God can and will if sought. And so then it says at the next paragraph on page 60, it says, being convinced, meaning being convinced of these three things, we're at step three. Good question. Thank you. Back to the beginning of the book. So we've got this idea that it's a precise set of directions, and that's the place we're going to start reading from. And then if you skip forward to the forward to the second edition, third and fourth edition books, Roman numeral 20, the top of the page, it says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those stayed on with AA showed improvement. So the statistics that AA has to offer us are pretty great, because prior to AA, there was no solution for alcoholism. And what they found, and this is 15 years after the first printing of the book, what they found was that of people who came to AA and followed the precise set of directions, right? He's got this line in here where it says, of those who came to AA and really tried, on Roman numeral 20, forward to the second edition, about 75, maybe 85% achieve lasting sobriety. Those are outstanding statistics. Now, what's the operative word or operative phrase in that statement? Really tried. Exactly. Really tried. What happens for us is we come into AA, we go to a few AA meetings, or we go to a bunch of AA meetings, we listen to what other people say, we determine that we've got a problem with alcoholism or that we are alcoholic, and then we depend on going to AA meetings in order to keep ourselves sober. That doesn't produce the necessary spiritual experience that's required for us to achieve lasting sobriety. Remember, when we skip forward to page 84, we read the result of working up to step 10. At that point, we found that we were recovered alcoholics, and we stopped at the bottom of the first paragraph on page 85, where it says, we are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. But there is a caveat. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. What a lot of us don't ever do in when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous is keep in fit spiritual condition. A lot of us never even establish any level of spiritual condition whatsoever. So for us, what ends up happening is we don't have a mental defense against the first drink. If we find that we're alcoholics, part of what that means is that we've got no way of thinking ourselves sober. It's just not going to happen for us. And so our sobriety, is, as we found out in A, B, and C on page 60, our sobriety has got to come from a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And so often what happens for us in AA is that we stay sober based on self-knowledge. We know we're alcoholics, and we know what we hear other people say in AA meetings, and we start trying to put some of that into practice in our lives without actually working the 12 steps. And so what ends up happening is shortly thereafter, the desire to drink comes along. We have no mental defense against the first drink, and we act on that desire, and we get drunk again. And we wonder how it could have happened. But the statistics that AA has to offer us back in the foreword of the second edition on Roman numeral 20, are that 75-85% of the people who come to AA and really try, meaning really put the program of action into application in their lives, achieve lasting sobriety. You won't find another treatment center anywhere in the world that offers those statistics. I don't know if that means that the AA way is better or not, but what it tells me is I really want to try to put this thing into application as they intended for me to do it. Because what I need the most is lasting sobriety. What we're going to go after is understanding the precise set of directions and how to put those into application in our lives. That's the path we're about to embark on. Moving forward into the doctor's opinion. Does anybody know why there's two doctor's opinions? First doctor's opinion starts on in the third edition, Roman numeral 23, and in the fourth edition, Roman numeral 25. But then you'll notice that there's a brief interlude where A interjects a few things, and then we've got a second doctor's opinion. Why do you suppose that is? Can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Two doctors.
Nope, only one doctor, Dr. Silkworth. Any other ideas? Ma'am?
One alcoholic, then another.
So he wrote the first doctor's opinion before he had seen any alcoholics getting sober, and then the second doctor's opinion later. Unfortunately, that's not it either. The first doctor's opinion is a letter introducing the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And then we've got this brief part in the middle where Bill Wilson writes, and that's on Roman numeral 24. In the third edition, it's going to be on Roman numeral 26. And about halfway down the page, the paragraph starts, "The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that this explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account." So what do you think he means by that statement? As laymen, it doesn't mean much. But as ex-problem drinkers, this theory, our belief in this theory of an allergy, explains other things which otherwise we couldn't account for. What does he mean by that?
It explains the phenomenon of craving.
It explains the phenomenon of craving. Exactly. So what Bill's telling us is that how many people may have ever experienced this? At some point in your life, somebody looked at you and said, "Why don't you just stop drinking? It doesn't seem to work so well for you." Or, better yet is, "Maybe you should just drink beer or wine, right? Lay off the hard stuff. Shouldn't you just control your drinking a little bit? Instead of having 16, try just having 6. Right? Lots of times in our lives as problem drinkers, we've had other people make statements to us about controlling our drinking. This idea that we have an allergy and that our desire to drink comes as a result of that allergy explains for many of us why we kept on drinking in light of all the information that told us we should stop. This idea that we have an allergy explains for us maybe even an entire pattern for us in the way that we've been living life and in the way that we drank. It's a real big deal. Many of us, for the first time, we read this and for the first time we find in this book an answer as to why we've been so screwed up our whole lives. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. So it's good news for those of us who are here in the treatment center because you're in the right place. Until an alcoholic is removed from the immediate effects of alcohol, there's little information that's going to be exchanged that's going to work out well. But the important thing in this statement that we just read, back again on the doctor's opinion, is that we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. So we've got to understand what those two words mean. We talked about it briefly earlier. What's spirituality? A relationship with God. A personal relationship with God. Very good. What's religion?
Yes, a set of beliefs.
A set of beliefs. It's more than that. A set of beliefs, a practice of traditions. What else? A very structured practice of beliefs, right? Somebody else.
Structured set of penalty and habit experience with God.
Great. A structured set of beliefs designed to help you have an experience or a relationship with God. Anything else? That's pretty much it, right? Religion is a design that a lot of people follow together in their lives in order to establish a relationship with the divine or with a power greater than themselves or with God, however you want to look at it. So how does that differ from spirituality? It's organized. Sometimes we call it dogma. There's a series of things that we all follow that are the same. They've been laid out before us. But what we understand is that spirituality is different from religion. You can be religious and have a spiritual connection or have spirituality. How does spirituality strictly differ from religion? It's personal. Exactly. So here in the bottom of page Roman numeral 24, 26 in the fourth edition, here where they say we work out our solution on the spiritual plane. What they're telling us is that a part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, half the program, is what I do to have a personal relationship with a power greater than myself. Later in the book, they're going to tell us that the main purpose of this book is to introduce you to a relationship with God or with a power greater than yourself that's going to provide you with a solution to your problem. So that's the first half. The second half is the altruistic plane. So what does the word altruistic mean? Selfless. What else? It's not quite selfless.
Serving others.
Serving others. It's not quite serving others. What else? One at a time. Louder, please. Not quite, because you're expecting something in return. When I do 12-step work, I know I'm going to get something. I'm going to stay sober. That's why there's an entire chapter called Working with Others, because my program, after I've gone through the first 9 steps, turns on being of service to other alcoholics, right? What else does it mean? What's altruism? What's it mean to be altruistic?
Charitable.
Not charitable. What else?
Outside
of yourself. What else? Altruism. The idea of altruism is that I'm going to give of myself to somebody else, and I'm not going to expect that person to do anything directly in return for what I'm doing. That's different from saying that I'm going to give to somebody without getting anything, because I'm going to get a lot out of doing 12-step work. My whole life is actually going to depend on me doing 12-step work. In the chapter, There Is a Solution, he says, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we can help meet their needs. So altruism is giving of myself to another without the expectation of that person remunerating or paying me back in any way, shape, or form. So we've got two terms, spiritual and altruistic. We work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. Half the solution is being in a relationship with a power greater than myself, and the other half of the solution is looking in my life to see where I can be of service to those around me. That's the AA solution. That's the way that we try and work our way of life. So, in the doctor's opinion, skipping forward one page, Roman numeral 26. In the fourth edition, it's Roman numeral 28. The top of the page, he says, this is Dr. Silkworth speaking, he says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Dr. Silkworth is introducing to us this idea of the allergy. What we find in Alcoholics Anonymous and what they found when they wrote this book was that alcoholics weren't drinking just because they liked it. We were drinking to overcome a compulsion that was a result of an allergy. We're going to learn more about that as we go along. Chris, you want to start reading at the bottom of the page? Men and women drink essentially?
Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to their desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
There's a lot of information in that paragraph. First of all, we start drinking because we like it. Everybody likes the effect, well, most people like the effect produced by alcohol. I can go out on a limb and say that everybody in this room likes the effect produced by alcohol. The problem for us is that it's so elusive. That line between feeling great and having your life get ruined is pretty blurry. And so what happens for us is we go on drinking and drinking and drinking, thinking that there's nothing wrong and that alcohol is serving us a good purpose, without ever seeing that it's destroying our lives. We can't differentiate the true from the false. We're incapable of seeing the effect that our drinking is actually having in our lives. Sometimes you'll hear people refer to that as being in a state of denial. Like right now, you're locked up in the treatment center thinking that everything's okay. And as soon as you get out of here, everything will go back to normal. Then he tells us, he says, the difference for the alcoholic is that we're restless, irritable, and discontent. And unless we can experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, we remain restless, irritable, and discontent. So we started off drinking because we liked it. We like the effect produced by alcohol. Then we start using it as a solution in our lives for the way that we feel. We medicate ourselves with it. Then we see the other people in our lives drinking as if there's no problem whatsoever, and we think, well, I should be able to do that. And so we go on chasing that dragon, so to speak, over and over and over again, repeating the insanity of the experiment of the first drink, waiting for the time when it's going to be different. So it says, that the alcoholic types are drinking because of the manifestation of an allergy, and that this differentiates us from all other drinkers. Is anybody in this room allergic to anything other than alcohol? Anybody allergic to bee stings? Anybody allergic to medication?
Yes. Sulfa drugs.
Codeine. You're allergic to codeine. I think I may be allergic to codeine also. Whenever I take a little codeine, I tend to break out in jail and treatment centers. Okay, so if you take any codeine, what happens?
I get sick.
Okay, what do you mean you get sick? Because I get sick too.
So I throw up.
You throw up?
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the first thing that happens if you took a pill that had codeine in it? What would be the very first sensation or feeling that you would have?
Nausea.
A little nausea. Okay, then what would happen?
Then I get sick.
Okay, then what would happen?
Then I'm weak.
Okay, then what would happen? That's everybody else in the room. We're craving for another one, right? Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. You're going to take one little pill that's got codeine in it. Okay, now what's the first thing that's going to happen?
Nausea.
A little bit of nausea. Okay, then what's going to happen? Stop right there. It's okay for you to have the nausea. Right? A little nausea is not so bad, right? But I don't want you to throw up.
Okay?
So don't throw up.
Okay.
But you're laughing. Why are you laughing?
Well, I'm not trying to throw up.
Well, I know you're not trying to throw up, but what's going to happen anyways? You're going to throw up.
Yeah.
There's really nothing you can do about it, right? But I told you to not throw up. I want you to exercise all your willpower and all your mental control, and I want you to prevent yourself from throwing up. How's that going to work out?
It's not.
You're going to be sitting in a pool of vomit, right?
Right.
Right. Okay. So the problem for you is that you have an allergy to codeine, right? And that's a physical reaction. You throw up when you take codeine. And there's no mental control you can exert over that. Is anybody allergic to bee stings? So what happens if you get stung by a bee? What's the first symptom after you get stung by a bee?
Usually have a little lightheaded.
A little lightheaded. Okay. So, you just got stung. Now, what's happening?
Still lightheaded.
Okay. Now, stop right there, because lightheadedness and dizziness are kind of fun for us, right? Okay. Now, what I want to happen is you can feel lightheaded and dizzy, but I don't want you to swell up like a blueberry.
Ooh. Not
going to
happen.
Not going to happen. But think about it a lot. Like, really exert all your willpower on not swelling up.
Can't control it.
Can't control it. Why is that?
Allergic.
You're allergic to bee sting. See, when you're physically allergic to something, what that means is you're going to have a physical reaction to whatever it is, no matter whether you want to or not. And so for the first time, Dr. Silkworth explains to people way back then, in the mid-1930s, that the alcoholic is like a person allergic to a bee sting. And that what happens for the alcoholic is that we have an allergic reaction. Does anybody know what that allergic reaction is? It's called more. The allergic reaction that the alcoholic has, which sets us apart from all the other types of drinkers, is that we have a craving to drink more. And so when we started off the doctor's opinion by saying that as ex-problem drinkers, this explains for us many things for which we could otherwise not account, what we're saying is that we physically react differently than other people do to alcohol, and the reaction is we have to drink more. And so if you find that you're an alcoholic, what that means is that we can never use alcohol safely in any form whatsoever, right? We just finished reading this paragraph, and then the next paragraph on Roman numeral 27, Roman numeral 29 in the fourth edition, says, on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. So you see that what Dr. Silkworth didn't say is that we can control the amount of liquor we're going to drink after we take the first drink. What he said is that through the psychic change, complete change in our thinking, we're able to control our desire to drink. Our control, as he puts it here, comes from a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. But for an alcoholic, once we take any alcohol whatsoever into our system, once we take the first drink, the craving takes over and we're done. We're doomed. Most of us come into AA for the first time and we think that the problem for us is like after the sixth drink. If I could just control how much I take, if I could just stop after a few, then I would be okay. That's not the solution at all. For us, the problem is the first drink. Once we take the first drink, our bodies react. The phenomenon of craving develops. The response to that is to have more. And from that point forward, we have no control. Question? Well, that's with certain allergies, right? But lots of allergies show up in lots of different ways. We had one person who said that with their allergy, they have hives.